Okay, 65. The other little detail is, which we'll be seeing from time to time, is that the stranger is his medieval precedent would be Mercurius. Just to remember that. We'll talk more about that. He's the big guy in alchemy. But what Jung says, I think, fits so well. Mercurius tempts us out into the world of sense. See why the German idealism is so contrary.
Who tempts us out into the...
Mercurius. Mercurius is just the medieval name for the stranger. And he plays a very big role in alchemy. We'll be looking at that throughout. Another way to put what I just said is that the response of the unconscious to Pauli's question is the image of Mercurius, mythologically spoken.
So there's a connection between Sophia and Mercurius, right? I was trying to dig that up, but I didn't have Jung's text.
Probably you could find it. If you want just a quick spiel on Mercurius, maybe. The problem with Mercurius is he's everything. Mm-hmm. And he would be the medieval name for Mercury, which was the Roman name for Hermes. But he undergoes some transformation but from the time he's first seen in the Greeks until you see him in alchemy. And you can see him representing in alchemy the prima materia. You can see him representing the goal, the lapis philosophorum, the goal of alchemy, the valuable stone that they're trying to make, or the gold. And he's described as the process that links the two. So it really is everything. But remember, you're dealing with the medieval mind that didn't make distinctions. But on one hand, he's the prima materia. On the other hand, he is the inner spirit within the prima materia that transforms it into its final state. So it's the beginning, it's the means whereby in the middle, and he's the end. And he is a thonic god. Remember, thonic was earthy. Literally, it meant the gods below the earth in its first derivation. But it just come to mean anything that's earthy and sensual and sexual. So he would be the alchemical parallel to Christ. He's the alchemical redeemer. But we've been talking about him in so many words all along. His thonic nature, his being the prima materia, would be the desire that gets you into a situation. He would represent as the beginning state the Pauli's desire for von Franz. And inasmuch as we've said that beginning state carries with it its own spirit, that experience is part of a guiding experience, Mercurius is also the spirit of guidance that's inherent within the instinctual experience. And since that experience is pointing somewhere, he is also the goal. Why did the alchemists pick Mercurius to name this image? I think because originally Mercurius was a messenger. Hermes was a messenger. So Mercurius, the messenger quality of Hermes is the movement nature of Mercurius from the beginning to the end of the experience. That there's a dynamism in the instinctual experience, which is the spirit, which leads to the end.
he also was the only God that could move between both worlds.
And
so,
right,
he really was the wholeness.
That's very important. So he's both the material experience and the spiritual transformation through the experience. And sometimes he's depicted as a hermaphrodite, often with wings.
Man, you have half the Caduceus right there.
I guess I do, don't I? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Intertwined snake.
The snake, yeah. Jung has an essay on him, and it's either volume 12 or 13, I think. And basically, he says Mercurius is everything. So, and of course, he's got many different chemical. He would be like Quicksilver, and other qualities. He's got a wealth of imagery associated with it, which shows up when you're trying to work with somebody transforming a beginning state to an end state. So he's both the beginning, he's both the means whereby, and he's the end. And he is just an image of everything we've said today. He's everything we've said put in an image.
So that appears in the dreams?
Well, he appears in Pali's dreams. He's the stranger.
Oh, yes.
And this is what got cut out from valid experience in the Western mind at the birth of science. And it's pushing to be reintegrated. The sense of mystery and the marvelous. But that all got cut out. And another way to put what we're talking about is what we've got to do is find a way to bring that sense of life back, but that is not in contradiction with our scientific view of things. I'm taking French again, and I'm taking a class in French medieval literature, and we're reading all this early Arthurian legend. And every time there's a crossroads or there's a stream, there's a little miracle that happens in this literature. You know, the sword dances, or somebody appears, or Merlin appears, and see that's all Mercurius. That sense of the marvelous and of the supernatural permeates all that literature. And when science comes, that just gets cut out. That doesn't exist anymore. But that's Mercurius. Now they believed it literally, apparently. And what we're trying to do is see, can we bring it back as a metaphor? Swords don't literally dance across streams, but when you need to change your attitude, which would be a metaphorical stream crossing, just the person you need or just the experience you need might appear to get you to do that. But since science excluded it literally, it will not now be able to recognize it metaphorically, and that's what is pressing on Pali through the stranger and through his archetypal background, Mercurius. How do we again open ourselves up to the mystery and not give way to magical thinking? And superstition. Another way to put it. And again, it sounds so almost academic until you realize that what Mercurius is arranging for him is an adulterous love attraction. Then it isn't so theoretical anymore. And we're looking again at this in Pali's personal life and in how would science change if it could recognize meaningful coincidence as a valid piece of data. The way it deals with it now, it says it is an anecdote, it is not data. It means it's not, it only is data if it's repeatedly verifiable. So again, that is still cut out of our canon. And what I get out of Pali's dreams is that this is the next step of science. And this may have something to do with whether the world survives, given that his question was, how does science need to change to keep another Hiroshima from happening? And, you know, it's not immediately obvious why that would be the response, but somebody mentioned it here loosely, and I think what it does, you see, it reevaluates, it makes us reevaluate our power attitude. Because we don't control synchronicity. Synchronicity controls, or at least affects us. So this is the way that the power drive meets its match, so to speak, by taking these experiences seriously. Very close. As I understand this other image, she has two historical streams. One from the Old Testament that she represents the plan before creation. Remember in Proverbs 8, God has a girlfriend, and that's Sophia. And it doesn't say so in the text, but the way she has been interpreted in legend, in Jewish legend, is that she was the plan by which God created the world. So if you interpret that, she would represent what we call a priori identity. She is the plan of ourself before we're born, which we, through life, try to actualize. The other the other historical thread is through Gnosticism. And there she was, remember Gnostics thought that when God created the world, he gets trapped in it? So that in some accounts it's not God, but it's Sophia or Sophia who gets trapped. So that Sophia is the little sparks of God trapped in the world. Which, again, if we interpret it psychologically, would mean that you come into contact with the spirit through your relationship to the material world. See, tempted into the world of senses. That's how you get the spirit. So in that case, it's very close to Mercurius. What Mercurius has that Sophia doesn't is this idea of the gradient movement from one state to the other. And what Sophia has that Mercury doesn't have is this idea of a priori identity. But they meet in the spiritual significance of matter. Matter guides us.
So you said Sophia doesn't have that movement through the stages?
Well, it's not emphasized. It's kind of implied.
It is if you think about her as being the pattern of your fate.
Yeah.
It implies.
Yeah, how else do you get there? Mm-hmm. But I don't, in her accounts, it's not emphasized that she travels. But in Mercurius, it's emphasized that he travels, which would be the traveling of your own growth through the experiences from beginning to end. And again, it's implied in Mercurius that there is something that you are bringing to being which is not of your creation. So who created it? Well, in the Sophia image you get, it was there to begin with. So they're quite similar. And of course the two images that are going to appear in Pauli's dreams, main images throughout the rest of this material, are Sophia and Mercurius. That's the response of his unconscious to his question, what do we need to consider to change our destructive power drive? And the response is, you need to consider Mercurius, and you need to consider Sophia. That's it in a nutshell. Everything we do is just a refining and giving examples and looking at instances, looking how he deals with, looking what it's doing to him of these two main archetypes. Well, he fell into despair when the bombs went off. And he came back to Switzerland and he couldn't work anymore. I mean, he could teach, but he couldn't. He had no energy for creative work. And so he said to his unconscious, what has gone wrong, where do we go from here? And then took that question to Jung, and that's then what these dreams are a response to. These dreams are a response to that question. What went wrong?
In that,
you know, literally these guys developed physics drinking beer and playing ping pong. These guys just having a party. They were in their early 20s. And 10 years later, it was a mushroom cloud over Hiroshima. He's going, what happened? We were having fun, chasing girls, drinking beer, and playing ping pong. And all of a sudden, the world is now prepared to blow itself up hundreds of times. So that's the question he put. What did we not understand? What do we need to understand happened? And think, how can we prevent this from happening again? How do we need to change so that it doesn't happen again?
Can I interject a little bit of events that happened over the summer while we didn't meet? There was a proposal on the table by the Department of Homeland Security and various military to test this new generation of low-level nukes, what they want to call it, like the bunker-busting nukes. And it was originally planned for just in Nevada, and it got stopped. And this was in like May, finally, after months and months and months, it got stopped. And in the context of responding to a reporter's question, Department of Energy spokesman said, yeah, but we're looking at testing it somewhere else, including Mitchell, Indiana, and somewhere else. And, and this is, so what they were looking at was a quarry, a limestone quarry just south of Bedford in Mitchell, Indiana. And it turns out they had actually, over the last 2 years, each year they've tested bombs there as well. The idea being that the terrorists are going to hide underground, and Iran's got this nuclear facility underground, and that we want to try to get rid of them by bombing them. And so what we need to do is to test the effectiveness of this stuff. So they were going to test, in southern Indiana, a simulation of a nuclear-type explosion. It wasn't going to have nuclear material in it. Actually, the composition of the bomb was similar to the one that was used in the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma by Timothy McVeigh and his accomplices, plural. The thing is that there was a massive outcry in the activist community, both the peace and justice community and the environmental community and stuff, because of the outcome of this. And Senator Lugar wrote a letter said, to the Department of Energy, asked, is this going to happen or not, or will we give you some definitive information? And so he was told, no, it is not going to happen in Mitchell or anywhere else at this time. They left it open that it could happen some future time, but not necessarily in Mitchell, Indiana. And so, but anyway, it's just interesting that this stuff is not theoretical, this notion of us blowing ourselves up and stuff, or blowing the enemy up. But now we're thinking of a kinder, gentler nuke, so to speak, that's going to be really specific. It's not going to be something that goes, spreads the fallout widely. It's going to be very, very focused. And so that kind of thinking that still drove Pauli into despair is still active in the world today. And there are plenty of people who are not necessarily driven into despair, but into action as well, at least momentarily, have seemed to have averted it. That's the current event aspect.
Well, in a way, I think we were so rightfully, worried about what's going to happen with airplane bombs and IUDs and whatever they're called. And No.
I'm not worried about those.
What are you saying? What do you call those?
IEDs. Improvised explosive devices.
Well,
some of us carry those with us.
Fortunately, there's no relationship between them.
No.
I didn't say that in public. That we forget that there is a nuclear danger. But now I think North Korea and Iran, it's scary.
So would you say another way of posing this question is, how can we compensate for the destructive power drive that has gotten us this far in... you said something, I don't know if you said something like that.
Well, if I would try to rephrase it, let me think. I think what we come down to is that the basic orientation of the Western ego is power. We do things to the world. And that goes back to Descartes. That's why we get Descartes appearing here. you know, his model is there are thinking things and extending and extended things. That's how he phrased it. And that means that we are subjects that act on the world. And the extension, and there's no built-in limiter to that. So the more we act on the world, the more we're fulfilling our vision of what we're about. And you take that to its logical extreme, and that is war and nuclear destruction. We act on the world. And his question really goes to the heart of, I don't know if he put it this way, but what it in effect goes to is the heart of how we look at life. That the problem is how we look at life. That's what caused Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that we are subjects that act on and impinge on the world. And what these visions are doing is showing there's another way to look at life. So it's going way back to the very first cause of how we are approaching the world wrongly, which we don't see in everyday events because they're small little errors, but magnified and taken to its logical extreme, it's a very there's nothing to keep us from doing what we can do, and then we don't judge whether that can do is a good or a bad. Does that make sense? It really reevaluates the basic I cause and effect on the world model of Western consciousness. And that's the secular time. But what he's being shown is there's another dimension to time in which you don't act on the world, but the world acts on you. Now, this isn't going to change Iran or Korea, but it's just showing him how consciousness needs to evolve in the long run if we are going to start making different decisions. It's very subtle. I think that's one reason it's so hard to grasp. It doesn't give you, so what do I do about it? It just says the reason we have created a world like we have is because that's the nature of our presuppositions when they fulfill their logical conclusion. So we need new basic presuppositions. And that's what was working on him. It's the attitude. And you see it then in him, how he can't deal with a moment where time is trying to control him. When I say time is trying to control him, that just when he needed it, there she was. Just at the right time.
I was just thinking of the ideal and how they think.
Well, we'll get into that.
That whole recognition that there is
right.
There is something.
So remember the I Ching hexagram number one came up. Now another image we're going to see is the Chinese woman. So we'll have Sophia, and she's really related to Sophia, but you could, in a way, think of her as separate. Three main images are Hermes Mercurius, Sophia, and the Chinese woman. So we'll be looking at how do the Chinese view life, and how can we incorporate that into our life. Projection and Recollection. I think it's in Psyche and Matter, von Franz tells a dream. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Hiroshima Milan Amore. Ever seen that? It's a beautiful film. It's about a love affair between a French woman and a Japanese guy after the war. And you don't know at the end of the movie if I don't want to ruin it for you, but you're not sure at the end how it's going to end, how the relationship's going to end. I'm making it simple so I don't ruin the movie for you. Well, von Franz reports a dream that somebody had that said if they resolve their relationship, this French woman, a Japanese guy, if they resolve their relationship, the world will survive. If they don't resolve the relationship, the world will destroy itself in a nuclear holocaust. So another image that we'll be working with is, what of the Chinese mind do we need to integrate into our worldview in order to keep science creative and not allowing it and our political process and our government to take this destructive course. And of course, remember, this is work for the future. That's why it was the nose. We're talking here in terms of hundreds of years, I think. But just as science has evolved from the medieval era to now, why won't it evolve again? Think of the fundamental shift in the way we look at nature from the 17th century to now, and there will be another one between now and the 24th century. So I think that's what we're dealing with. I mean, they're big questions. But we'll see. And those of you who did number in time, did you ever ask yourself, why does she talk so much about the Orient in there? Well, now you see why. And we'll be looking at that too. Okay? Does that help you grasp the larger questions that we're dealing with here? Because it's so easy to lose the forest for the trees in this stuff. You know, you get so bogged down in all these images, but that's what's going on.
It's funny to me that he was brave enough to say, I'm not going to work on that bomb.
Mm-hmm.
He was brave enough to do that. But when von Franz is saying, look at your inner life, you really weren't going to do that.
It shows you the power of an IUD.
Well, I think that's what, I mean, I think that's what, we don't know, the power drive is so pervasive. We don't see it, we don't connect it to each action we take in our day-to-day life. How do we relate to somebody, or do we relate to somebody, or why are we just jamming our stuff down their throat? And, you know, he could see it on his professional side, but not his everyday relationship side. And that, I think that's so... We're so blind to that.
I think it's because a woman was involved, and that for that power drive is so threatening.
I think one of the reasons why we don't recognize this yet, that I think that power drive is connected up with controlling nature, mm-hmm. and that pervades out a whole
exactly.
of existence.
So if we don't control nature, what other paradigm do we have to understand our relationship to it? Well, synchronicity is going to be the new paradigm. And this will be worked out. Wait a minute. This, we're raising questions that we'll be going through again and again and again. All this stuff will be, particularly when we get to the Chinese images. And here we have, you know, dark women asking him to lecture, and pretty soon it will be Chinese women asking him to lecture. Okay, 65. I see large striped objects lying on the floor. They look similar to coconuts, but are somewhat longer and are of a gray-green color. I should have looked back. There's not really much, but there's a little picture of it back in here. Letter B in the back of the material. It's way in the back, very last couple pages. Let's go to page letter B, and it's on the lower left. Yeah, that's page 78 is the German edition. Yeah, that's the German edition.
These are coconut. That's a coconut.
That's a coconut. Now the stranger, so here he's back, comes with a big hammer and smashes them one after the other. And no stripes, right? At that, the stripes vanish. Then he takes the broken pieces in his hand. The pieces are like shell-shaped containers, and to my astonishment, I see they contain a liquid clear like water. The stranger drinks this and immediately becomes progressively younger, his gray hair becoming darker and finally brown. I say it is important that the objects don't have a power of their own. See? Well, he can't stand the thought that an object could have a power over him. He can have a power over it. The juice appears to have the healing power. He nods in the affirmative and adds, "When I drink this liquid, I don't need to go to war." Could that be more clear? Kepler also acted similarly. So right there you see the relationship between I don't want objects to have a power of their own and the issue of war. Again, it may sound strange, and when you talk about this stuff in public, people look at you like you're a nut. But you know from your dreams, those you've done dream work, that you get ideas in dreams which are way in advance of what's going to be your program for integration in a year or two. And they don't make immediate sense at the moment, but in time they do. And so we've learned through dream work just to accept these apparently weird links between the power of an object and war. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that.
Well, I was thinking in terms of contradiction. We say we want an equal relationship, or we want to have a relationship, but then we resist it too. We don't want
we
to
do
not
everything to fight it.
That power equal. And then we say we don't want to go to war, but we go to war.
Right.
I mean, not war, war throwing bombs at each other, but we have war.
And we also throw bombs at each other. Yeah.
Or silence.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's like, I mean, we're so contradictory in ourselves, you know.
And that's part of what we're doing here, is looking at our contradictions. That's part of what analysis is about, where you say one thing and you do another. It's humiliating. Now, about this time, the relationship with von Franz was picking up. I think where we were told, what, in 1950... I guess they had known each other from the 40s. But they really began a personal relationship, more of a personal relationship, around 1950.
Where are you now?
I'm on page 66. And what happened was von Franz sent Pauli a copy of her essay, The Dream of Descartes, which itself is a fantastic essay. The Descartes is really the guy that started all of this stuff. Because he's the philosopher that said, I think, therefore I am. And so I, as a subject, am a separate entity who acts on the objective world. He started it all. Or he articulated, you know, the basic way of looking at the world that science was about to take up. And it's in a book of hers called Dreams.
Dream.
Published by Daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N, Verlag. Verlag is just German for publisher. And there's several of her essays on dreams, and I don't want to get us off track.
No, but I don't want to go there. I just want to know where I can do it.
Yeah, but I just wanted to say very briefly that when Descartes developed his philosophical system and some mathematical constructs, like he, you know, remember the Cartesian coordinates from algebra in high school? Well, Cartesian is Descartes. He invented that. So just when he was doing that, he had some dreams which completely compensate what he was doing, and she wrote an essay. Oh, that's a very beautiful essay. Might even be something to do sometime. It's about 100 pages. It's really a monograph. Anyway, that's how they started to connect. And then Pauli writes about now the historical shift. that got us into the current subject-object, subject works on object model. Right, as far as the anima, as far as concerns the anima, the 17th century was about removing the soul from the physical world. That's what, remember I said in that literature, you've got all sorts of miraculous things happening. But after the 17th century, after Descartes, after Enlightenment, after the scientific revolution, that didn't exist anymore. With Kepler, there was still the soul of the planets and the animae anima terrae, the soul of the earth, as the anima mundi, the soul of the world, became dubious. With Descartes, even the soul of animals was denied, and the only thing that was left was the anima hominis, the soul of humans. So, at the birth of science, we are still allowed to have a soul, but not the earth, and not the universe. And the soul of the universe, the soul of the earth, would be what they thought was moving those miraculous events that they were perceiving. Thus, the tendency was more and more to limit the soul to the individual human being. What was given up, what became unconscious, was the idea of an objective psyche. In the 17th century, the psyche was subjectified. So he's looking now at the historical transition that got us into the current state that all this synchronicity stuff is meant to add to. And that's what she talked about in that paper as well. Now, the author here starts talking about what is the water in those coconuts. And he refers to the aqua permanens. Maybe I should read the whole quote. The anima was set free not only by means of the cooking, but also by the sword dividing, typo there, the egg, or by the separatio, or by the dissolution of the four roots or elements. So what he's doing now, he's amplifying the chopping up of the nuts and finding the liquid inside from an alchemical imagery where the permanent water was recovered from a nut by slicing it. So he's giving an alchemical amplification to the coconuts. To make a long story short, I think that's probably enough of that quote. The aqua permanens is just another name for Mercurius. Although it's Mercurius in water form, you might say.
Does permanent mean?
Permanent.
Permanent?
Yeah. In the sense that it is, again, remember it's not logical, but it is the water which is transformed into a permanent state. So the aqua permanens isn't permanent until it becomes permanent, but that's the idea. Yeah, like one of the goals might be they produce gold. Another goal might be they produce diamond. Another goal is they produce permanent water, meaning permanently capable of producing healing and miracles. They had many different descriptions of their endpoint.
So that's what it's permanently capable of producing healing.
Yeah. And now we would interpret that metaphorically, capable of helping us shift our attitudes towards ones that are more realistic and enduring. So that's what he's getting out of the nut, was the capacity of his psyche to change his attitudes to what is necessary. for his own personal life and to those attitudes that are corrective to the errors in the Western way of living, Western way of seeing. So the stripes would refer to this nature of experience that's trying to direct him by creating a relationship with Bonfance through her synchronistic presence in his life. Does that make sense if I put it that way? We've got three things going on. We've got the nuts, we've got the water, and we've got the stripes. And the stripes would refer to this rhythmic nature of time. The time has special moments. Well, he's in one of his special moments, meeting her, getting in touch with her. That's one of his special moments. That's why the coconut is striped. And within that special moment is the possibility of reorientation. That's the aquapermanence. It's not really saying anything new, but it's giving another image to what we've been saying. So you see how the psyche is trying to drive home this point to him. You are in a special moment, and this is a moment of alchemical transformation towards the answering of your very question. You okay with this? But, of course, we see he doesn't want objects to have a power of their own. So he's not going to be willing to accept that this experience is going to have a power over him. He wants to control his experience, and he doesn't like his experience to control him.
His power. I mean, he doesn't want the object to have power over him. The object being specifically really is one thing.
The experience of being attracted to somebody that doesn't fit with his idea of himself.
So, non-instinctual, right?
No, the experience would be very instinctual.
No, I'm saying what he wants.
What he wants is to be a hair professor who's in charge of everything, and who's looked up to by the dignitaries.
Isn't that power?
But it's power. Yeah, it is power. But what he's being given is an experience that's going to humiliate him in the face of his power, draw the criticism of the dignitaries, and turn him into a blubbering idiot. And he doesn't want to be dissolved by his desire. He wants to stay in control of himself. He's in basically a sexless marriage, as far as I can tell. Certainly, it may have been sex, but I'm not sure there was much passion. And he's stable. But along comes something to destabilize him, and he wants to be able to control the object, not here so much a thing, but a objective event in his life that's going to have some effect over him.
If he gave into it, then that would just upset his whole feelings. Like, I mean, he would have to admit that he had feelings.
Exactly. And that they would start controlling him.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And most of us don't really, I mean, don't we all want to be in control more or less?
I think we do, but if you have any decency, you realize that life's bigger than you are. And you get thrown things, and they require suffering, but they are what are going to get you where you want to go, which is becoming a more complete person. Mm-hmm. And you accept them in the context of your larger hopes for life. Mm-hmm. See, that's the cooking. The other thing, I think, he says, what does he say? Was that he ties the coconuts down to the fruits of love. Nothing we haven't said, just... Yeah, here he says, the nuts can be interpreted as the fruits of love. Second line after the quote. Page 66. This, the last paragraph, second line. In Polly's Dreams, the next line. See it, everybody? Well, again, we've said it as much, but... You think of coconuts are sensuous fruit. I think that's how he gets to that.
What does he mean? How does he mean it when he says the nourishment is not for God? The nourishment in the nuts.
I think it's for the self.
And how does? But what does that mean? If it's for the self, does that mean that the self getting a nourishment for life that bypasses the ego?
Well,
has to go to the self first, and then
that. That there's a long-term development that it will nourish. The long-term development of his life and the fulfillment of his purpose, it will further that. Though in the short term, he is inconvenienced by it and distressed by it. So it doesn't, at the moment, it doesn't feel like a gift to him. But if he could step back from his own ego and see that life is giving him a chance of development, then the self would be nourished, his purpose would unfold, and there would be a deeper, quieter satisfaction than just the conditions of his vanity.
So it will filter down to the ego.
It should, yeah. But at the moment, it's like this is so hard on his vanity. And he's stopping the larger thread because it doesn't fit with his image of himself as a hair professor. And I think I mentioned to you, these guys are God. They just published a book in German of Pauli's life, which I read over the summer. And I'll bring it along. There's a picture of the view from his writing desk. I mean, you would kill to have that view. It is prime real estate. Mm-hmm. It is looking at over the lake with, I mean, this guy had it absolutely made. He was the top of the top. And now he's being challenged with this young woman who is upsetting everything that he thought he'd accomplished.
I have to say that I know we're saying vanity, and I totally agree with it, but look at Young followed his path, and today we read about him, he's
yeah.
trash today.
Yeah.
He's probably not trash
right.
today. So, I mean, it's huge, it's bigger than just
I guess you could say it's survival in a way.
Yeah.
But it's survival of your reputation.
Mm-hmm.
See, the work continues. It's benevolent influence, even though you may be vilified. You may be vilified, but his work is still having an effect. Pauli's work isn't having an effect. Well, it is in a way, but thanks to our pouring energy into it, but he would be regarded highly, but where did it lead?
Yeah.
So that's the difference between ego and self. The self would be the part of you that has an effect and continues working, and the ego is how you're perceived. Well, it's you're in luck because I got a clock right in front of me, so I'll have to stop on time. Well, we didn't get all that far, but we got over to page 67. I would say 70, oh, read 77, read to 70. I don't think we'll get farther than that. Because, see, we get the Chinese contents in the next chapter, so we'll need to spend a little bit of time on what does that mean. Well, I'm glad you're all back. Thanks for coming.
It's refreshing.
See you in two.
It's so good to just get your mind going again.